I want to welcome everybody this evening to what I think of as a very important topic. And I'm going to get myself right out of the way here and introduce our first speaker. The structure of the evening is that each of the speakers is going to give a short 10 to 15 minute presentation, and then we'll all sit down together and talk about some further topics, and at the end there'll be time for questions. Our first speaker is going to be Judy Klitzner. Judy Klitzner is a senior lecturer at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, where she's taught Bible and biblical exegesis for the past 18 years. Many of her students, now teachers and heads of Jewish schools, employ her methods throughout North America, and she lectures widely to a wide variety of audiences, including future Jewish educators at the London School of Jewish Studies and Jewish Federation groups throughout the United States. She has published articles on biblical topics, and her book, Subversive Sequels in the Bible, Male and Female in God's Dynamic Image, is due to be published by the Jewish Publication Society in the fall of 2009. And on this Sunday morning, Mrs. Klitzner is going to give an in-depth seminar on Piece of Tanakh, but tonight obviously is organized around a different topic and something to do, alas, with her life experience.
Does this work? Ah. Do you want me to go there? Oh, better. Okay. This all seems terribly official. Hello. Hi. Can you hear me? We need this, right?
Yeah. Oh, for the recording problem.
Okay. You don't mean that? Hi. So is Elliot... said, I've been working on a book. No, I'm not going to plug the book, but I am going to say that I've been spending the last 5 years on this thing, and it's been a lot of research, very data-based. And this is very unusual for me to be here where we have the people who have all the data. I'm not here to present that. I'm here to present a much more experiential side of this question. Did you say what the question was, by the way?
Not a question.
What did you say? Our
frame it, I guess.
What did we call this?
Protecting our children.
Protecting our children. Okay. So I'm here to, I guess, present a living story of what could happen when we don't protect our children. Unfortunately, the story that I'm going to tell you is a personal story. But I feel that in some ways... if you are looking for data, my presence here could be misleading, because you might think that if you heard this woman talking about this topic and her own experiences, that it's something that you could see more often, and something that people could easily get up and do and say, this happened to me, that a rabbi assaulted me. And in fact, you will hear it very rarely. You will almost never hear it, because this is a problem that... by its very nature, engenders silence, thrives on silence. So in many ways, I'm not at all representative of this problem. I would say the problem engenders silence for internal reasons, shame, confusion, and many other things that I'm going to elaborate on, and for external reasons, which is an often... conscious and orchestrated effort by a rabbinical establishment and the community at large to silence the problem. And I want to talk about those two things. What happens within the mind and the psyche of a person who has been victimized by a religious figure? And the other is what's happening around in the society that surrounds this rabbi in order to continue to enforce silence. So my story in short, I'm really going to tell it in short, and I'm going to direct you to the Jewish Week article in, I don't remember what month, June of 2000. Where there was a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi who was the head of a youth group, NCSY, Rabbi Baruch Lanner. Was a very charismatic, very successful regional director. And he over the course of 30 years was assaulting what I would say was undoubtedly hundreds of girls, and there is one statistic that I will stand by this evening. There were always rumors. There were always kind of knowing but good-natured nods at his crude behavior and crude speech, at his insistent talk about any matters related to sexuality. My first experience with him was when he started kind of courting a non-religious friend of mine who was then about 16 years old. And this was my first exposure to the problem because she talked to me about it. And what she explained to me was that she was being gradually pulled into Orthodoxy through this rabbi. He was telling her all the wonderful things about Orthodox Judaism. And as she got closer to him and physically closer to him, she became closer to religion. And what was happening was she was kind of displacing her feeling of God for God onto this man. And he was very much encouraging that. He explained to her that the physical relationship was okay because this is what God wanted. God found this to be a beautiful thing because God understood that this was, you know, it was done for the right reasons. And this went on for quite a while until at a certain point his interest in her waned and he kind of dropped her and moved on to somebody else. And at that point, she dropped religion. And I was very disturbed by this kind of redefinition of religion to suit his own sexual needs. She was looking to him to be some sort of representative of Judaism, and he was looking to her as a sexual partner, which was completely wrong. I spoke to the head of my community, the Rebbetzin, who at that point had a very close relationship with him, and I told her how disturbed I was by what I had seen. And she went to him and spoke to him about it. She said she would have to ask him, and he assured her that none of these things ever, it was all a lie, and that this girl was a very sick girl. And so even though this Rebbetzin knew the girl, she accepted his explanation. And I should just say, just as background to some of the other things I'm going to say, this, for me, looking on from the side, this all had a very strong impact on me, seeing that an authority figure who's approached is immediately inclined to side with the abuser. I'll just cite one other example of things that I was seeing before my own story. Another friend of mine became involved with him. He pulled her in. He explained to her that if she had a kind of physical relationship in a shul, that was even holier than if they would have this someplace else. And basically what she was telling me was that this manipulation of her mind was the most dangerous part of what was going on, that she was losing her connection to herself and to her own sense of what was right and wrong, to her own sense of what was right religiously, morally, that his logic was replacing her own. And even though at a certain point he got violent with her, he broke her jaw, and she said that wasn't the greatest injury that she sustained had nothing to do with any physical injury, but was this lingering psychological injury that he inflicted on her. Eventually, his interest turned to me. I was 16 years old. I was the regional president of the New Jersey region, and which he had completely orchestrated. He pretty much set up the job for me. And everything was all very confused, very caught up with issues of hierarchy and control. He was the man who was pulling all the strings in the region. I would go to board meetings that I was supposed to be running, and he would disappear into a closet with one of the girls. He would pick a girl one at a time. They'd go into a closet, come back out, the girl looking very embarrassed and, you know, put herself back together, and everybody else would have to pretend that they didn't see anything, but everybody knew what was going on. Anyway. As I said, for the full version, you can see the Jewish Week. The short version is that I rebuffed his advances and told him I was going to speak to someone that I knew he respected. And at that point, he tried to strangle me. That's the dramatic part of my story. Thank God, you may have guessed, he didn't succeed. But I remember that one thought that I had while his hands were around my neck was, well, if he actually manages to kill me, he's not going to be able to talk his way out of this. I actually thought those things. And here's the question. The question is, I was a pretty confident, pretty successful teenager. Yet after a traumatic experience like this, I did not talk to anyone. And in that respect, I suppose I am a good representative of all of the other people who have suffered from this. That on some level, even though I was able to rebuff the physical assault, a certain psychological hold did take over me. Over the years, I've worked very hard to put the words together, and I've found it very important to be able to do so, and to serve as a kind of an address for the many, many, many other people who have gone through similar things with, unfortunately, many other rabbis. And I'm going to try to analyze a little bit with you, first of all, why it is that people keep silent. Why did I keep silent? I'll start with that. Okay, so to some extent, did I leave my watch over there? How am I doing?
You're fine.
As I said, his psychological control worked. I was convinced that he was the king, and in his kingdom, everybody played by his rules. One of the recurring themes in his address to his people was loyalty. That was the supreme value. I know at a certain point there were three victims, three girls who were rooming together on a summer program, and he was having his way with all three of them, and not one of them knew about the other. They were living together for an entire summer, but he so imposed this sense of silence and of loyalty that nobody dared to break it. Nobody knew who was speaking to him. He gave a sense that he was in control of all information, that somehow it would always get back to him, and he would punish people who weren't loyal to him. So people didn't trust each other. People didn't trust anyone else. People didn't tell anyone, including, and this is very important if you're talking about protecting our children, they don't tell their parents. They don't tell their best friends. They don't tell their teachers. They don't tell anybody. So speaking for myself, I would say that to some extent this psychological abuse worked, and I felt that I was silenced by this experience. A second reason that I would say was for my silence was confusion and guilt, the question of whether I did something to cause this. And being raised in a religious, getting a religious education, I think in some ways actually contributes to that sense. And this is, I think these are some, there's some very difficult questions that we need to be asking ourselves on this. Whether if our solution to problems of modesty, if the solution is always going to be that women are somehow responsible, that girls have to cover up so that boys who have no control over their animal behavior will behave themselves, there is going to be an internalizing of that by the young women, and they're going to think that if the boy wasn't able to control himself, maybe somehow she had something to do with it. He would often refer to some of these young high school girls as very provocative. He used those words about 15-year-old girls, so that it wasn't his fault at all. It was her fault, and that's something that I think that needs to be addressed in a very serious way. In addition, other contributing factors to silence: fear, intimidation, a fear of having to confront him, a fear that he was capable of saying anything or doing anything, and I never knew what, neither did anybody else. What we're talking about is, I think, maybe Michelle will help me with this, but sociopathic behavior, somebody for whom the truth has no meaning, and it's just as easy to lie as it is to tell the truth. Somebody who's capable of physical violence, that contributes to an atmosphere of fear. In addition, there's a desire to belong, and I would add this, that in terms of this youth group, that was something that was very exciting that came to my very dull town, in the sense that if I speak out against this, that all of that is going to disappear. In addition, and here I think this is something that many, many abusive authority religious figures have in common, is that they choose their victims very carefully. For myself, it was a time in which my father was ill, my mother was busy with that, and he counted on the fact that I wouldn't want to involve them, I wouldn't want to bother them. He had a kind of radar for the kid who wasn't going to do anything with this information. And I want to get to two more points, which I think are the most important points. One was the sense, very, very real sense, that nobody would believe me. And as I said before, he lied as easily as he told the truth, maybe more easily. And later, many years later, there was a din Torah brought against him, and many of these feelings became, I saw them played out. People I knew went to testify against him, and he was sitting in the room listening to them, and he would explain to these the dayanim in the room, well, this one is lying because she hates rabbis, or this one's lying because she has a fixation on me, this one's lying because she's a troubled girl and she makes things up, this one is lying because she misinterpreted my innocent gesture of caring. Whatever it is, there's always some explanation that has that will allow people to think the worst of the person who brings the complaint and always find a way to believe him. Worse than not being believed, I think that the single most powerful part of the silence is the sense that people know and they don't care. My first experience ended badly when I tried to speak to somebody. I knew other people who had tried to speak to higher ups in this organization, and they weren't interested in listening. And in addition to that, how could it be that none of these people saw what was so obvious? I mean, you spent 5 minutes in the room with this rabbi, and you heard the way that he spoke and the way that he and saw the way that he behaved, and you knew that there was something seriously wrong. So the sense was that, of course, they knew. They just chose to act as if they didn't. Do I have time to talk about why other people didn't stop him? Okay. So why did other people not stop him? Okay. For me, this is the hardest question of all. And this is for many years has plagued me. I can live with there being a lot of sociopathic people in the world. They're sick people and they need help. But what about the healthy people? And what about the holy people? Without whom these rabbis would not survive a day. I mean, they need protection. They need people to build this support system around them. What are they thinking and why are they doing this? So here, the list that I've put together begins with self-interest. Charismatic rabbis work very hard at getting close to money and getting close to power. They insulate themselves, they fortify themselves, they control other people's livelihoods. Sometimes they control the livelihoods of rabbis' children. I've seen that along the way. They make themselves impenetrable and very, very powerful. The worst reason that rabbis protect abusive colleagues is a kind of cynical cost-benefit analysis. He does damage, but look at all the good that he does. And I've actually heard rabbis say those very words to me. His superior in NCSY actually said that when somebody came to report an incident about Baruch Lanner. Yes, I've heard the stories, but he does so much good. I've spoken to other rabbis over the years, some quotes from those rabbis. Charisma is so hard to come by. We can't afford to lose him. Genius has a dark side. What are we going to do? I hope it's obvious to everyone here that this is utterly unacceptable. This is a mitzvah haba'a ba'avera. There's no justification for this whatsoever, but it happens all the time. Often it comes down to money. Do they bring in the numbers? Do they bring in the money? Then we have to continue their operation. Then there are the more prosaic reasons for silence. One, I would say, is simply the old boys club, a certain feeling of sexism. I saw a lot of this kind of tisking and winking and chuckling when they heard the way that he spoke and they saw the kind of disrespectful way that he treated young women. You know, it's kind of approving and disapproving at the same time, but enjoying it on some level, and that certainly went on. I think another reason for silence is this kind of excessive, inappropriate niceness, a misplaced sympathy for the abuser. What about his reputation? What about his livelihood? What will we do if we fire him? Where will he go? What will he do? I've spoken to rabbis over the years who simply don't want to get involved in all that nasty business, so they would rather just not know about it or talk about it. And they don't realize that their silence is simply lending a hand to the perpetrator. There are rationalizations. He must have done tshuva, even if there is no evidence whatsoever that any tshuva has been considered or carried out. He must have done tshuva. We give him the benefit of the doubt. Then the other rationalizations are maybe it was a consensual relationship. Yes, she may have been 14, but some 14-year-olds are very mature. And worse than this, and I'm going to draw toward an end of my opening remarks with this, is that if there is no physical assault, then nothing happened. Sometimes people will take this to the next step and say if there was no rape, nothing happened. But this idea that nothing happened if it isn't overtly physical is a very, very grave error. And so I'm going to end this part of my talk this evening by saying if you come away with only two things from all that I've just said, I would like them to be these two things. One is that silence is the oxygen of abuse. Mm. Okay? It's all about silence. It's about victims silencing themselves, and it's about people around the perpetrator working very hard to silence her. And the second thing that I want you to remember is that the worst part of abuse by a spiritual leader is the psychological and spiritual component of this abuse. The redefinitions of reality, the displacement of God onto the rabbi, and the utter abuse of trust. A youngster looks to a rabbi for guidance, for counsel, for truth. And the rabbi is responding with what is best for his own sexual needs with no regard whatsoever for the damage that is done to the victim. I have seen this, and I'm speaking now not as a victim of this, but as somebody who's worked for decades with many, many victims of the same thing. I've seen it in every denomination of Judaism. I've seen it in every branch of Orthodoxy. I don't know what the numbers are. Maybe you do. But my estimate is that although it's not worse in Orthodoxy than it is in other denominations, it is not better either. So that is my non-scientific impression. I can tell you that I have a friend who works in Israel. She's the head of a hotline for abuse in the religious community, abuses of all kinds, and she tells me that the numbers are the same in the religious community as they are in the secular community for abuse within families. My strong sense is that the same is true here. Okay, that's it. I'm going to stop here, but I would like for the questions and answers to plant a couple of questions. So will somebody please ask me later what I think has changed and what I think has not changed, and what do I suggest we do about this?
Center for Training and Research. Dr. Friedman is a highly respected psychiatrist who focuses on the Jewish community, and she has a special interest in the rabbinate and in pastoral counseling. As such, in addition to her private practice, she has a role teaching pastoral counsel at Yeshivat Chovei Torah, and she's an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a tremendous honor and privilege to speak here and to follow Mrs. Klitzner's remarks and to precede Rabbi Dratch. And I hope that I'll be a bit of a bridge in terms of some data and then some words from the pastoral counseling point of view. And then I think Rabbi Dratch will come in with a lot of very specific operational and other kinds of wisdom. I'm going to speak for my introductory time from my two perspectives, one as a clinician and a researcher, and then the second as the head of the pastoral counseling program in a rabbinical school. Mrs. Klitzner spoke very much from her own experience, and I'm sure that she would agree with me that we want to broaden the concern for boys as well as girls, because boys are also the target of sexual abuse, and also to broaden the concern about who is actually doing the molesting. And Mrs. Klitzner spoke in terms of the rabbinic abuse, but I think our concern also extends to educators and to people in general. How do you know who to trust, and what can you do about the adult side? And what I would like to get to also is what can we do in terms of empowering our children to be able to communicate, to have more sense of autonomy, power, control, pride, speaking back about their own bodies, about their own spiritual body connection. Okay, so from my perspective as a clinician, as a psychiatrist in the metropolitan area, I see a lot of, and also as somebody who's very interested in reproductive psychiatry, I see a lot of people from all branches of the religious world, of the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world as well. So I've been privileged to hear the stories of women really from the entire spectrum. I mean, really talking to New Square, Borough Park, Williamsburg, Upper West Side, Teaneck, Westchester, all over. And over the years, I was extremely interested in, what's the story in terms of numbers in this community, both in terms of sexual abuse and also in terms of larger issues of sexual life. So it's a number of years ago, some of you may be attuned to, about 1999, Ed Lauman and his colleagues out of University of Chicago published a mega study, the kind of updated Kinsey study on sexual life in America. And I was thinking, how would this kind of study apply to the Torah observant community? And so along with a group of colleagues, Dr. Rachel Yehuda, who was the first author from the Trauma Studies Department at Mount Sinai, we set out to look at what was the experience of sexual life of married observant women. And this became a whole project which we presented at the Orthodox Forum in 2005, and which when that topic was being considered. So I bring that up because we put out questionnaires and we spoke and asked for people to come forth. We got over 400 questionnaires, responses to this general question about sexual life of married observant women. Now, I'm giving you the details of this study. This is like the short version of the details because there's so much in Jewish sociology and Jewish community life is anecdotal and vignette. There is next to no data on any of these topics of enormous concern. So what we did in our study, and 380 is a big number, although it is not necessarily a representative sample, we can only say, and I want to really make this very clear, that our material is from the women who chose to answer our survey, which was put out there in a kind of what's called a snowball way. We tried to put ads out. We tried to get non-prejudiced responses from the United States and Israel. But it was not like a perfectly controlled study. We didn't go to phone books of shuls, or we were not given permission to sit in mikvaot and to hand out the questionnaire, which might have been the most unbiased sample. But we did get over 400 women who answered our survey, and we disqualified 20 of those responses because they did not check that they used the mikvah every time they should have or could have. So we had 380. Now, the reason I bring all this up, as I said, is because one of the things we looked at was histories of past sexual abuse. And out of that material, we published an article in the American Journal of Psychiatry, which was in November of last year, 2008. So if anybody is interested in going into this data, that's the citation, the American Journal of Psychiatry, a peer-reviewed, quite critical editorial board, November of 2008. So I want to give you a snapshot of some of the evidence, the data that we found, and then to tell you a little bit about some of the communal response to that data. So, as Mrs. Klitzner said, in fact, we found out of our sample, again, this is the last time I'm saying it, I can only speak for the 380 women who answered our questionnaire. I cannot vouch using statistically pure methods that they are totally representative, but I do think that they stand for something. Women wrote in very, very powerful personal stories, and we found that, yes, just like Mrs. Klitzner said, the statistics of abuse in this community were the same as the general public. We got a rating of about 26% of women who endorsed some form of sexual abuse in their earlier years. 16% of them was less than the age of 13. About a third was by relatives. Less than a quarter was by strangers. You can figure out the math. The in-between is a lot of people that they knew. Now, I'm just going to give you the highlights of this. As I said, for people who are interested, I invite you to get the paper, which is very available. What was very striking was that we found that there was less, perhaps, invasive, less genital contact among these young girls and women than maybe in the general population, the secular population that reports sexual abuse. But I want to underscore what Mrs. Klitzner said. It's not the degree of physical violation that counts or that matters ultimately, especially when you think about that these girls, many of them are coming from much more protected communities, much more sexually less obviously, you know, kind of out there backgrounds than the general population. So it's not like you can discount this evidence because they weren't as physically violated as their counterparts in the secular community. Something else that we found was that there was a much higher proportion of people, of women who had been sexually abused, who were from the Baal Tshuva community. And this was very, very striking. Again, these are women who are current, the sample, I just wanted to say again, these are women who are currently observant and observe the halachas of mikvah, taras mishpacha, scrupulously. So these are not the women who didn't get married for whatever reasons, maybe because of abuse or because of other issues having to do with personal life. These are not the women who left religious life. You know, we don't know who leaves religious life for whatever reasons, whether it's a history of violation spiritually or physically, whatever. So the data that we're getting is from women who are quite observant, very adherent to a religious life, and who chose to answer this survey. And we were very struck by this finding that when we looked at the data, 36% of the women who reported this abuse were Baalot Tshuvas, and the smaller number was from the from birth community. So and that's still 19%, so that's not small. 19 is almost 20%, that's a fifth. And we were quite struck by this, and we tried to understand this finding. And one of the things that we thought is that perhaps one of the responses to trauma, and sexual abuse is surely a trauma, is looking for a more protected, more ordered life, which is a religious life. This is certainly seen in people who have suffered trauma, such as in wars and other kinds of serious trauma. So that was a very striking finding. Interestingly, though, among the women who were from birth, the higher percentage of sexual abuse was in the more right-wing community. So we were quite struck by that. Certainly in terms of long-range impact, this is true of all communities in which abuse has been looked at. There are higher rates of distress. There are all sorts of, longer-term problems of some sort or another. As a matter of fact, I would say that you could look at the Baal Tshuva community. Really, that's an extremely high level and adaptive response to a tremendous trauma. Okay, of course, we want to, one of the things we wanted to conjecture about is why is this so? What is happening? The community does not seem to be growing up in religious life is not necessarily more protective. Some of the things we thought about is, again, the whole issue of tsniut. If you have, and modesty is not just how long your skirts are, how high your neckline is, but what words you can use. So if a boy or girl doesn't know who don't even know some of the terms for their own body parts, they don't have. It's not just that they don't know how to tell somebody. If you don't know the words for something, you feel like you're not supposed to know those words, and you're not supposed to talk about it because we know words for things that we can talk about. So if you just have like baby words or sort of vague words for bodily parts, for genitalia, for functions, it imparts a whole level of like, ooh, we don't talk about that. So it's the whole issue of how do you educate young people, girls and boys, young men and young women, to have modesty about sexual life, about physical functioning, about inner feelings, but also that this is something that you have an awareness of, that there is integrity in the body experience. How do we teach communication about these feelings, and how do we teach awareness if we don't use the words, if we don't speak about these things? The most shocking thing to me at this 2005 Orthodox Forum was not our paper or the response to it, but these two incredibly lovely Frum women who presented a Torah curriculum in education. And they had this very fine thing worked out. And one guy, this is an invited group of people, shot up and said, I can't believe it. We're working so hard to protect our children from this schmutz, and you want to bring it into our schools. And I'm thinking, like, we just said yesterday, because this is the day after, that we have a 25% abuse rate, and this guy is jumping up and saying this is schmutz. So there's like this disconnect between a kind of a fantasy that if we don't talk about this, and we chaperone our kids and we restrict their media or whatever, which I'm not opposed to entirely, that everything is going to be okie-dokie. And it just ain't so. And I think we have to really do some serious consideration as parents, as community members, as people who are participating in boards of schools and camps and all kinds of things, as to how we have discussions, how I'm sure Rabbi Drach will talk about this, how we have reportage all along the way. Okay, I'm going to now, I just want to spend a moment on the response to this paper. So it was really quite striking because a lot of this plays out, as Mrs. Klitzner referred to the Jewish Week, in the newspapers. It was very striking after this paper was published how these blogs and various writers took offense and kind of lumped our research and our presentation as yet another one of these schmear jobs that people are doing to knock the Orthodox community, and how we, as everybody who worked on this paper was Orthodox themselves, should have known better, should have thought about this. Our data is not representative. They even, and these are fine thinkers, who said, well, these women were Baal Tshuva, so the people who abused them weren't Orthodox men. I mean, it was mostly, you know, men abusing women. As though the fact that these women are in the community now and are fine, upstanding members of the Jewish world doesn't matter. I mean, it was really quite remarkable to see the kind of, in other words, also support, and there was a lot of people who thought about this, but it was very striking to see in the blog sphere the kind of exactly what Mrs. Klitzner was talking about, a combination of this silence, you know, negating, minimizing, all this kind of stuff. Okay, I'm going to now switch hats and talk about my work at YCT, Yeshivat Chovei Torah Rabbinical School, where in that regard, I wrote a chapter that's coming out in some book sooner or later boundary maintenance, boundary adherence, boundary violations, and this is for rabbis, but I would say it applies to educators, really to anybody. By the way, the larger piece on the abuse data was culled from is going to be published, I think, sometime next year by Rabbi Mark Angel in his very interesting volume, which I'm sure many people here read, Conversations, in which he takes up different topics and explores them with different writers. So there will be an opportunity to see the larger data and our thoughts about sexual life and the observant community and all of that. But the couple of points that I want to make about pastoral counseling and boundaries is that it's critical that, just as I said before, that we have to teach young people that they can talk about in appropriate and modest ways their feelings, their sexual feelings, issues that they're having, that they can go to trusted people and speak about this in an appropriate way. It's critical that we teach our rabbis, our educators, people in charge, people out there, we cannot, you know, reach every parent, but certainly, or hopefully we could, it's critical for people to be aware of their own feeling life and to know and to have a sense of when they're getting into trouble. Now, I want to make a differential between, and this is a very rough kind of thing, between two kinds of offenders. There's a kind of offender that Mrs. Klitzner was unfortunately had, her experience and has done an amazing job speaking about, which is kind of the serial offender, the predator who is really looking, as she described, in a very cagey way for kids or for adults for that matter. And I just want to make a point, certainly with children, but also with adults. When it comes to positions of power, there is absolutely no consenting adult. There's certainly never a consenting kid, but there's no consenting adult when it comes to some kind of sexual manipulation violation, because the rabbi, the educator, the person, whoever it is using, is playing with the whole kind of transference of power, the whole mind manipulation thing, to entice this person, to get them to do whatever he or she wants to do. It is rare, it's more rare that it are women who are doing this, but that has been known to happen, and quite recently as well, because there's a lot of stuff in the media about this now. But so there is this serial predator who is, I think, much more in the sociopathic realm and is a much more recalcitrant, difficult to treat kind of situation. There's also, however, and I want to mention this, the person who is in trouble and is not necessarily a repeat offender, but maybe is having a dark time in his or her own life, maybe his or her own marriage or career or finances or whatever, is just failing, and some pretty or handsome or whatever young thing comes through, and you know, there's a couple of later night chats and something happens. I am not in any way saying that that person is less guilty or less responsible, I'm talking about the power person, for what happens. But I think in terms of, and I assume Rabbi Dratch is going to talk about this to some degree, I just want to put it out there that I think that there's a different category of people in terms of, let's say, the capacity for tshuva, the capacity for reflection. I shouldn't say the capacity for tshuva, that's more of a religious realm, a capacity for a psychological reflection. But I think a person, there is such a thing, I do think there is a difference between the serial offender and somebody who slips once. I think that needs to be put there. But I do believe it is critical that in our training programs for people who are working with young people, that they are given awareness training of their own feelings. Because we want our religious people to get close with our young people. We want them to touch their lives. We want them to be transformed or continued, mobilized into active and passionate Jewish lives. And if you're going to be active and passionate with young people, sooner or later, you're going to be turned on in some way. You're going to be excited by a person. You're going to find them lovely. You're going to find them attractive. And the rabbi or the teacher needs to know that in him or herself. They need to know that so they don't get in trouble. Because my mantra is not what do you do if there's a violation or a slip. What do you do when there's a slip? Because there's for sure going to be that. There isn't a school anyplace, an honest teacher, a principal, or rabbi who doesn't report, you know, that they had some kind of feeling at some time. And it's what you do with it and how you chaperone yourself and how you help out somebody that you're mentoring. You know, it's the wonderful rabbi or the principal who somebody comes to about such a problem and says, you know, I think I'm kind of mixed up in something. I would be so happy to hear that. And I hope that the training that we're giving the smicha candidates at YCT is helping them not only to identify their own feelings, but to be there for one of their colleagues, if somebody should call up or email or say, you know, I'm feeling kind of funny about something, can you help me out? Because just as Mrs. Klitzner said, the secrecy is the oxygen of abuse. And it's so important that we train the people that are in charge to be aware of their inner feelings. I mean, I could go in great length of how we do the program and this and that, but now isn't the time for that degree of detail. And so I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to turn the mic over to Rabbi Dratch. And I look forward to our discussion later.
So Rabbi Mark Dratch is well known to all of us in this room. He was formerly the rabbi of Sheresh Maim here in Toronto and is a very respected leader in the Jewish domestic violence community with expertise and experience in issues of domestic violence and abuse, and a track record of successful achievement counseling, advising, writing, lecturing, advocating, and formulating policy. Rabbi Dratch founded JSAFE, which is the Jewish Institute Supporting an Abuse-Free Environment. It's a non-profit organization committed to affecting the way the Jewish community addresses issues of domestic violence and child abuse.
Thank you very much, Dr. Malamit, and it's a pleasure to be here with you, with Rabbi Kelman, Rabbi Strockler, with the panel, and to be here in Toronto. You picked the coldest night and the coldest weekend to come back, but the reception is warm, so I appreciate that. There is too much to say and not enough time to say it all, so I'd like to divide my discussion into two parts. Part of it to give a halachic framework for addressing some of the issues that were raised before, and part of it's in just practical suggestions in terms of how I see we can begin to address the problem. When we speak about abuse of children, abuse of adults, and the engagement of religious authorities, of rabbis, in dealing or not dealing with these abuses appropriately, what I see comes is a second layer of abuse in terms of the abuse of halacha, where principles and values of Jewish law that are good and noble values, that were meant to protect people, that were meant to elevate people, are misused and misapplied and misinterpreted and form a second layer of abuse. So not only has that person been physically or sexually or emotionally abused, they've been spiritually abused if the abuser, if the perpetrator was a rabbi or an educator, and now they're being abused yet again by the system, whether it's the rabbi that they approach for help or the Beit Din, the rabbinic tribunal that they go to for adjudication, or the Jewish community that may not want to hear about it, talk about it, or may reject comments and complaints that are being made. So just to highlight bullet points in some of these issues, because they need to be put on the table. One of our biggest issues is the issue of denial. It just doesn't happen. And as a rabbi and educator, I would like to tell everybody that we have a perfect, wonderful community. This is the best of all possible communities, in which people are spiritual, in which people are noble, people are ethical, et cetera, et cetera. But we know that it's not true. And when we're afraid to admit it, we then create a whole other layer of irresponsibility. So lahavdil, if we compare our community to the Catholic Church, and it's easy to look to the outside and understand what their problems are, with all the problems of pedophilia they have with the priests, the biggest issue of credibility and the spiritual abuse of the church was not so much the priests themselves who were abusing those in their charges, as bad as that was. It was the cover-up. It was the denial. It was moving a priest from one place to another. It was the lack of sensitivity and help that was given to people in their charge, young people for whom they were responsible and whom they failed. Take that and apply that to our community as well. When we're afraid to talk about these issues or afraid to acknowledge them for fear of how the community is going to be perceived, what impact this may have on the religious commitment of individuals within our community, and we wind up with individuals like a Baruch Lanner or a Yehuda Kolko of Yeshiva Torah Tamima in Brooklyn, who for 40 years was molesting, or allegedly molesting, it's being taped, I have to use proper language, allegedly molesting first and second graders. A Moshe Eisman, who was the Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide at Ner Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore, who for years and years is alleged to have been involved with members of that student population, or Shlomo Carbach. Many allegations against him for very inappropriate behavior, intimate physical contact with large numbers of women who came to him for spiritual guidance and for inspiration. Now, I mentioned him last, but perhaps he's the most significant, because it's easy to dismiss Baruch Lanner. He's been in jail, and people generally, they knew him in New Jersey. They didn't know him here in Toronto. So we can go tisk, 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 and we can dismiss him and not engage with him. And same thing is true with Yehuda Kolko in Brooklyn, who our kids didn't go to his school and haven't been involved with him. But there's Shlomo Carbach, right, who we sing his songs. And it's hard to go to a synagogue these days that doesn't have a Carbach minion. And it's hard not to go to a Jewish bookstore and see numerous books of stories and inspiration from Shlomo Carbach. So what do we do as a community? As rabbis, as lay people, as members of congregations, how do we deal with this? So the denial is on many, many, many levels. And the response, or the lack of response, is on many levels as well. My sister-in-law was preparing a class in Pirkei Avot last summer, and she did some research. She wanted to discuss it with me beforehand. So she says, oh, I just did this wonderful research, and I used the book of Rabbi so-and-so. I said, I don't know. Rabbi so-and-so was involved with young boys in his yeshiva in California, and I don't know that I would use his books and his Torah. There's a Gemara that talks about, the verse says in the prophet Malachi, Ki sifte kohen yishmeru dat, v'tar yivakesh mipihem, ki malach Hashem tzivakotu. That priests, the teachers of God, are compared to Malachi Hashem tzivakotu, to the angels of the Lord of hosts, and you should seek Torah from their mouths. So either they're messengers or they're angels, and then you get to the boundary issues, and if they see themselves and they're perceived as angels of God, what does that mean? But essentially, says the Gemara, if they don't act properly, they don't act in angelic ways, then you shouldn't learn Torah from them. So what do we do with the books of this rabbi? I said, I wouldn't use his book. She says, okay, so forget him. But this rabbi so-and-so, he's got an interesting insight. I said, Rifki, he's also on my list. So she looked at me. I said, do me a favor, don't talk to me. Prepare your class. But what do we do? What do we do as a community? And these are, what kind of message are we sending? Not only to the victims, but how are we teaching? What are we saying to our children when we reject the teachings or the stories or the inspiration or the songs or the music of these individuals, as hard as that is? Right? I mentioned Carbach's name in a lecture, but no, don't talk about him. I don't want to hear about that. What do we do with it? And I can elaborate at great length. I don't have the time to do that. So the denial there is a very significant issue on many levels. People don't want to report. Right? They're told you can't speak about these things as lashon hara. Right? It's gossip. It's slander. You can't say such things. Let it be said very clearly that when there is a toelet, when there's a positive purpose for which negative information is shared, it is not prohibited speech, but rather it is mandated speech. The Netziv says in his comment in Hameg Davar, in his commentary on the Chumash, if you look at that verse that prohibits this prohibited speech, Lo telech rachil ba'amecha v'lo ta'amor al damrayecha, ani Hashem. That you can't walk around as a talebearer, because if you do, the second clause says it's tantamount to standing on the blood of your neighbor. You're guilty for destroying that person's reputation, his character, his life. However, at the same time, says the Netziv, Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, you shouldn't go about as a talebearer. However, at the same time, Lo ta'amor al damrayecha, don't stand on the blood of your neighbor. So that if you need to speak out in order to help someone, in order to save someone, in order to protect someone, there's an obligation to do that. Large numbers in our community are willing to do that when it comes to a shidduch. If somebody calls up, I want to set up so-and-so with so-and-so. What do you know? What's his social security number? Or I forgot what it's called here, your social insurance number. Right? Where has he been to school? What age was he potty trained? When did his mom? I mean, all kinds of strange questions people are asking to figure out whether it's appropriate, even to set the couple. They haven't even met yet. Right, but it's a heter, it's permission to ask thousands of questions and to, if it's okay for a shidduch, and I'm not so sure it's as okay as people think it is to the extent that they think it is, or with regard to business or with regard to so many other things, it's certainly permissible to speak about these things and to speak out about them and to share the information. So lashon hara there is not an issue, and we need to teach our children that. Remember one of my children coming home from school one day, looking rather disturbed, and I said, what's the matter? Well, something happened in school. I think she was in second or third grade at the time, but I can't tell you because it's lashon hara. So was her teacher successful or unsuccessful? So teacher sensitized my daughter to lashon hara. That was wonderful. It didn't last too long altogether, right? But about it was a wonderful lesson, but the teacher failed. Because if we teach that lashon hara means you can't share information that is important to you and that is endangering you or that is bothering you to a parent or to a trusted adult, then we have failed in that lesson of what lashon hara actually is. Then there's the issue of shanda. Can't talk about it. What are the goyim going to say? What are the orthodox have? What are the non-orthodox going to say? Right. So we're airing our dirty laundry in public, and going back to the comparing it to the Catholic Church. It's a bigger shanda when it's found out that we knew about it and didn't do anything about it, or we knew about it and didn't do the right thing about it, than when people say, oh, these people are being responsible. They're standing up. They're accepting responsibility. They're doing the right thing. You mentioned Dam L'Chavzkus, giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. Wow, he really is a wonderful guy. He really couldn't have done. We don't really have proof. We really don't know. There's an obligation to give the benefit of the doubt. Number one, to whom do we give the benefit of the doubt? The rabbi and teacher, or the innocent child who's coming to complain? And the overwhelming majority of accusations of abuse are true. They're not false. So to whom are we giving the benefit of the doubt? And are we willing to give the benefit of the doubt to protect someone's reputation and innocence at the expense of someone else's innocence? And not just the innocence of one person and one victim, but usually of many, many victims? Again, I don't have the time to go into the details. All of this, actually, if you go to my website, www.jsave.org, on the resource page, you'll find numerous articles that elaborate on all of these topics at great length. Then we're concerned about reputation. What are they going to say about us, about our family, about our children? This happens with abused women. I can't tell you how many women I've met who have said to me, I thought I was the only Jewish woman to be abused. Doesn't happen in our community. Or women who said, I know I was being abused, but I can't come out and say, what? Because I can't say anything about it publicly because, but what will they think about me? Or my husband? Or my children? or my family or my community. So we're concerned about reputation. Concerned to go back to the shidduch question, right? If it comes out that there's been abuse in the family, either spousal abuse, intimate partner abuse, or child abuse, then what's going to happen to the shidduch? This poor child now has been, and there was a case recently in Brooklyn, the girl was all of 8 or 9 years old, and the family didn't want to come out public with regard to that because what's going to happen in 10 or 15 years when she has to get married? And then that's it, ineligible for marriage. Now, I would much rather have my child marry someone who had been abused and who dealt with it in a responsible way, who came from a family that dealt with it in a responsible way, than to marry into a family in which there was tremendous dysfunction, psychologically, emotionally, in terms of the relationships, because there was abuse and it wasn't dealt with properly. I hope I'm not an exception. I hope I'm not in the minority, but we need to talk about these things. And that's part of the silence. And if we talk about one of the ways in which our community as a community can protect our children, it's programs like this, and it's conversations around dinner tables, and it's conversations with our children, not to be afraid to talk about it, so that if there are issues, they'll feel comfortable speaking about it. So we didn't have great numbers. We don't know numbers because people are afraid to talk about it. The Center for Disease Control of the United States government tells us that one out of every four women in the United States has been the victim of some form of abuse during her lifetime. One out of three or four. That's an amazing, amazing number. Okay. But we Jews know we're better, right? So how many Jews in Toronto now? Let's take 100,000 just for 200,000. Greater Toronto, okay. Do I hear 250? 107. Let's take 200,000 Jews, okay? Kane Yerbu. 200,000 Jews in Toronto, which means there's 100,000 women, give or take, right? Let's assume that Canada is no different than the States. So we now have 33,000 Jewish women in the greater Toronto area that have been the victims of abuse or will be the victims of abuse sometime in their lifetime. 33,000. But we're better. We Jews know we're better. Okay, we're twice as good as everybody else. So it's not 33,000, it's 15,000. Let's assume we're twice as good as that. So 7,000? What number are we willing to settle for and to say it's not an issue when it's not a problem? And if it's 7,000 or 10,000 or 15,000 or whatever the number happens to be, it's our mothers, our daughters, our sisters, our cousins, our aunts, our friends. We all know people. So unless we're willing to talk about it, to talk about it in a program like this, to speak about it, rabbis speaking about it from the Bima on a Shabbos morning, talking about it in our schools, having it written up in our newspapers, just having it as part of our conversation, we are doing a tremendous disservice through that silence. I have 3.5 minutes left. Tshuva. I wrote a piece on tshuva a number of years ago as part of I did some interfaith work in this area as well, and there was a special issue of the Journal of Religion and Abuse. There's a journal today for everything. There was a special issue on forgiveness. And I figured, well, it's really not a Jewish problem, it's more of a Christian problem because the whole issue of their Savior and forgiveness and the pressure to forgive and all kinds of stuff. And my dear colleague, Dr. Marie Fortune, who's a real trailblazer in this area, had been speaking about this and writing about this some 25, 30 years ago, and she's been a tremendous inspiration to me. And anyway, I was writing this volume, but I contribute the Jewish piece. So I write the Jewish piece on this. We all know that forgiveness really has to be earned, that the perpetrator has to feel sorry for what he has done or she has done, resolve not to do it again, make amends, make everything okay, ask for forgiveness, and then maybe, right? And then maybe. And I go on to show that when it comes to these areas, unless the perpetrator actually admits it and won't do it again, and then makes the victim whole again, that victim has no responsibility, no obligation whatsoever to forgive that perpetrator. Now, it may be good for the victim ultimately for himself or herself to forgive just so that it's part of his or her healing process. That's a different question. There's no obligation. You know, I was speaking at one, I went to Minnesota in January. I get invited to all these places in January. And I'm speaking in Florida in June, so you can imagine what's going on here. Not good. Something's wrong with this. Anyway, I'm ready to get up to speak. The Jewish Family Service there is launching this new program. There are hundreds of people coming. It was a wonderful program. The speaker was amazing. And 2 minutes before I get up to speak, a woman comes over to me. "Rabbi, I want you to know I'm really very strong now. I got divorced from a terribly abusive husband 10 years ago. Everything is great." And she looked like she was really well put together. And then she burst out sobbing. She said, "But I can't forgive him. And I feel guilty. I can't forgive him." I said, "In 30 seconds, I have to speak. I can't talk to you now." I said, "The bottom line is forgiveness needs to be earned. Needs to be. If he hasn't earned it, he doesn't deserve it. I wrote this paper. Go look it up. Give me a call. Here's my card. Be in touch." I couldn't deal with it at the moment. Anyway, two or three days later, I got an email. I printed it out. It was 5 pages. My mother could not have written a nicer letter and testimonial of that. But it gave her permission to feel what she was feeling from our Jewish perspective. So in that sense, I don't know, it doesn't make a difference to me whether it's a serial perpetrator or somebody who's just having a bad day or a bad set of circumstances. If they have harmed that person, then that person, I don't know, has the obligation to forgive them. It may come into the mix in terms of trying to understand, but I'm not sure that this obligation is there. And we can talk about that at a later point. Anyway, final issue, halachically, is the issue of reporting to the authorities. And you hear this, unfortunately, from a number of, and this is what actually got me involved in the business, when a pediatrician was told by a prominent posek that the pediatrician was not permitted to call the police and inform them about child abuse of a patient in the practice, just have this bus driver who was driving the second grader dismissed from the bus route. They found upon investigation this bus driver was being reassigned from one yeshiva to the next in Brooklyn every couple of months. So you knew what was going on. There is no prohibition whatsoever about making this report. I can quote great names of great rabbis from Rav Yashov, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zichrono Livracha, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Oldenburg, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Gedaliah Dov Schwartz from the RCA Bezim, Rav Herschel Schachter, and the list goes on and on and on of individuals who come out squarely with an obligation to make the report. Nevertheless, there's still a lot of pressure not to make the report, fear of ostracism, fear of all kinds of things. Let it be said that if rabbis of a Beit Din is not competent, the Beit Din is not competent, doesn't have the expertise, doesn't have the authority to deal with the issues, doesn't have the power to enforce consequences, which no Beit Din today does, then one does not have to go to the Beit Din at all, but go straight to the police, go straight to the authorities, and make the report. This despite the fact that there are rabbis on the record saying that these things are prohibited, and some of the logic is just beyond belief. Menashe Klein, who was a very prominent Hungarian posek in Brooklyn these days, the author of Mishnah Halachos, it was asked about a case of a young girl who claims to have been sexually molested by her father. Can they call the police? Writes Rabbi Klein, black and white, you can't make this stuff up. Writes Rabbi Klein, well, you can't believe the girl because she's a minor, and minors are not believed. The mother, who tells you this? Well, the mother is a woman, so women are not believed as witnesses in a Jewish court. And besides that, she's related to the father, so she's a relative, and relatives are not believed. The physician, well, all he knows upon examination is that something happened to this young girl, but he doesn't know who did it. And besides, it's a prohibition of the Syria. You can't make the report. You can't call the police. And this man is fine enough standing and has a good reputation in the community. You cannot make the report. I think every step along the way, Rabbi Klein is wrong. He's a big posek. I don't have the title posek, religious decisor, before my name. But he is wrong, and I will stand by that. I can point to sources that say that where you don't have kosher witnesses, any witness is acceptable. Man, woman, child, relative, non-relative, and I can prove you black and white with regard to those sources, and they cannot and should not be ignored. I had one case, and this goes back to accepting responsibility. I had one case in this Yehuda Kolko case, this teacher for 40 years, 20 years before there had been a Beit Din that convened and investigated, and one of the great prominent names in the rabbinic world in Israel today came to the conclusion that, pardon me, there was no penetration, therefore nothing prohibited took place. This rabbi does not understand what abuse is and does not understand the halacha, despite the fact that he has the name Posek before his name. Anyway, 20 years after that, just a couple of years ago, I got a call from individuals who were working with a 22-year-old in Brooklyn. The statute of limitations for reporting for criminal complaints of abuse as a child in New York State are 5 years after turning 18. So once he hits his 23rd birthday, he can no longer file criminal charges. Other jurisdictions have, fortunately, you know, give more time to the victims, and work needs to be done on that. Anyway, he was 22 and a half years old. His rabbi told him he needed permission, a heter arkaos, permission to go to court. They called me. I said, I'll write the letter yesterday. It's not a problem. First of all, why didn't his rabbi write it? Secondly, this is Brooklyn, so we've got to play the name game more than not what the law really is, but, you know, it's the name game. So I spoke to four different prominent rabbinic authorities whose names are well respected. Each one of them told me there's an obligation for this young man to go to court immediately. None of them would put their names on it publicly. When I said to one of them, if you don't do it, I will, because we have to stop this man, his response to me was, but you also have a wife and children. In other words, halachic policy is being made in Brooklyn these days because of fear of intimidation and bullying, despite the fact that the verse says in the Torah, Lo sagru mipnei ish, don't be afraid of anyone. And one has an obligation to stand up, despite the intimidation and despite the bullying, to do what is right. That's what we need to do as a community. I didn't get to any of the questions that Michelle posed that I was supposed to deal with. But we'll talk about it in the questions and the answers. Thank you.
I'm just going to pose a few questions from up here and then throw it open to the audience. I did actually want to begin with a practical inquiry, and anybody here can answer it. Very simply, a child mentions to his parent that something's going on at school, something's going on in a Shabbaton that makes him or her uncomfortable, somebody's touched the child, a rabbi's touched the child. What I want to know is, what should be the parent's first phone call?
Well, I think that the parent's first phone call is going to depend on what the outcome is of a very long conversation with the child, because I think that's really where it's got to start. So let's say the child is talking about, okay, a school or a Shabbaton. The parent wants to get some detail down, and the parent wants to be doing this by telling the child all along the way that it's important. This is a good thing that the child is talking to the parent, that this is really, that this is something that's so important that parents and children talk about, because that kid is going to feel scared. That kid knows that this is some kind of taboo, cootie, whatever it is, area. And then I think after the parent has gotten some information, and then presumably, hopefully, the parent has sent their child to some kind of situation, it's a school, it's a camp, where they would have some sense of who is the appropriate person to go to, whether it's the principal or the camp director or the school psychologist or some person they have a sense of. I think it's important to go to somebody that they feel a trusted connection to, rather than the kind of like maybe the sort of most administratively in charge person. But I think that's really the order to go, and I hope that a parent would have a sense of who they feel connected to in that institution if they've chosen to put their child there.
I just want to add a depressing rejoinder to that. I agree with everything you said, and that's the best case scenario, the first case, and ideally that there would be response on the part of the responsible parties. Unfortunately, I've seen many times that does not happen. If it's a school, if it's a camp, I recently spoke to, and first of all, I just want to say, of course, you know, this is a very big problem for boys, in some ways even more difficult than when it's a girl who's assaulted by a rabbi. But I've spoken to some young men who have told me this one boy went to the rabbi in charge of, to the principal of the school, a rabbi, to tell about another rabbi who had assaulted him, and basically told him it never happened. And the rabbi who was assaulting him, while he was assaulting him, said, this is not happening. But So sometimes you get into this Kafkaesque reality where it's just everybody turns the other way. There was a horrible story in a high school, very, very prominent, very well-known, respected high school in Jerusalem, where a rabbi on staff was having a full-fledged sexual affair for a year with a high school senior. And this high school senior came to speak to someone in school, spoke to a woman who's a friend of mine who was a teacher there, and she went to the principal of the school, and the principal did nothing. I know.
On to the second call.
Okay, right. No, but first of all, it's interesting to see a reaction. We think we've heard everything, and then we hear something else, right? There's always more that just defies belief. But when I first started dealing with this in Israel sustained way, with trying to get together groups of women who would help push this problem, solutions to the problem. Some of them turned to me and said, well, what do we do? There was a pressing question. There was a rabbi in Bar Ilan, in the Midrashan Bar Ilan, who was assaulting women for years and years and years. And they're trying, we're going to talk to this one. We spoke to the head of the university, he doesn't care. We spoke to this one, we spoke to that one. And they look at me, I listened to them for about an hour. You know, what do? We did this, we did that, nothing happened. And this was not long after my experiences with all that I had gone through here. And I looked at these women and I said, I'm sorry to say this, but rak ra'ash. Just the only thing that seems to work is noise. I hate to be the downer here, but what I would say is make that first phone call and definitely try to talk to people. But there has to be a sense, the people in charge have to know that if they don't deal with the problem, there will be a much more unpleasant way that the problem will be dealt with, unpleasant for them. That if they don't do what they have to do and take the appropriate steps, that you as the parent are going to make sure that people know about this. And whatever chain you're going to have, how far you're going to take it, that has to be out there. And I'm sorry to say it, but I think that's...
Well, I agree with you on that. Yeah. And I think that what Dr. Friedman is suggesting is the responsible way of
Absolutely.
Doing things. Because things have gotten better over the years. They're not perfect.
Right.
But they have gotten better over the years. And there are many people in administrative positions who are now... very responsive.
Right, right.
So that's the first step.
Wait, can I just, before you say, I'm sorry, I really wanted to start by saying that I feel like I've reached, I don't know, some unexpected, wonderful Gan Eden here, that I hear the two of you speaking in this way. Things have changed and things have developed, and I think it's largely here in this country, largely because of the work that the two of you are doing. And I agree that things have changed, and what I said back then, early in 2000, I wouldn't say today. I wouldn't have answered those women the same way today and said rak ra'ash. I would say the threat of do all those things, and you actually have a prayer of getting somewhere with it. But at some point along the line, if you get stuck, they have to know that you're going to go somewhere else.
Right. Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, what you have today, in addition to that, are organizations like JSAFE, www.jsafe.org, or other organizations or other social service agencies that are available in most communities. So bringing somebody from the outside, sharing that information, not letting it stick with the principal or whoever it may be, becomes very important as well. And there may be relationships already developed or a sense of accountability to something, to an organization or institution outside of that primary institution, which can help move things along. When that doesn't work, then you have to bring out the rash, either in terms of newspapers, magazines. This Yehuda Kolko was in his classroom in Torah Tamima in Brooklyn for 40 years. The only reason he was put on administrative leave is because we had an article in New York Magazine, very prominent magazine, a whole article about this. A number of us participated with the author in that article. And it was an hour before the final deadline that the school finally called the author and said, by the way, he's no longer in the classroom, because they were afraid of what was going to be written in that article. So do you want to do it that way? No. But, and then you have the other case, we had, there was a 2020 or 60 Minutes, or one of these other national television programs, helped put certain kinds of pressure on.
the Internet, as irresponsible as it is, and blogs, as irresponsible as they can be, are also very, very powerful weapons. So it shares information, and it gets it out there, and sometimes false information gets out there, but sometimes very important information gets out there. And you can't, in that sense, I don't think that there is the Shan Dechil Hashem, desecration of God's name, aspect to it, because the job needs to get done. But I think that we now have responsible organizations and people in place that good things can happen, which maybe didn't happen 20 years ago. The postscript to the Baruch Lanner case is that Beit Din that exonerated him, you now have, has done a 180. Yeah. Rabbi Blau, who was on that Beit Din, is now one of the heroes of the abuse community. Rabbi Willie came out and spoke very powerfully, with great sense of charata, of contrition and regret for what he's done. And I know some of the work he's doing behind the scenes in trying to help people. So a lot of some good has changed. The community has changed since then. We still have a long way to go, but we're in a much better place.
I just want to briefly raise gray areas here. There are educators, rabbis who they connect to kids and they touch kids. They don't touch kids necessarily abusively, but their natural personality is warm. They put hands on shoulders, and I'm wondering, educationally, it can be confusing. Like, I've spoken to a lot of teachers who are actually in a very sort of no man's land. They feel confused about. They're certainly on board with the notion that there should be a zero tolerance for abuse, but they're unsure, insecure about their own sort of physical manifestation of affection for children. And I'm wondering what's the line that they should draw in your view?
I think we're all confused. I think we live with that tension, and as long as they're confused, that's good. Long-lived confusion, because it will keep them in check. Dr. Friedman spoke about those issues during her presentation. I would say two things. I would not want to ban physical touch between teachers and students of the same gender altogether. At the same time, I want it to be responsible, and I want it to be appropriate. So touching in inappropriate places is clearly inappropriate. Touching a student when that student feels uncomfortable with it is clearly inappropriate, and that question needs to be asked. And number three, I would say that if touching does take place, it needs to be in public and never in private. Right. So as long as there are other people around, so that helps then define that touch as being non-sexual and non-aggressive, and as long as that child is comfortable with it, then I think that there's room to maneuver.
You know, I just want to add something to that. There's a kind of a notion in my field in psychiatry and psychodynamics between a boundary crossing and a boundary violation. And the notion of a crossing is something that might be a little unusual. So maybe you would, this is kind of from the psychiatric world, so it's much more formal, but drive somebody someplace, or you go out for a walk with the kid, or you go out to a meal with a patient or a congregant, you play a game of ball, you lend them a book, or whatever it is. I mean, this would be totally typical. But the main difference is a boundary crossing is not something you wouldn't tell somebody. A boundary violation is something you don't want anybody to know. And people know that feeling. And I think, again, I want to get back to the, on the adult or the educator rabbi side, they need to be informed. Now, again, with the predator, they're sociopaths. They're not going to care about this. This will just be something that they manipulate. But for the people that are available, you want the educators, the rabbis, to be thinking about, when do I feel secretive about something? When do I feel this is kind of weird? When do I feel uncomfortable myself? Now, for the kids' side, I just wrote a little piece on this. You know, some people say, oh, you've got to tell kids, nobody should touch you inside a bathing suit line, whatever. I don't think you can ask kids that. I think what you want to teach kids, there's one thing you take away from this part of it. A kid should know, tell me if somebody touches you in a way that feels uncomfortable. Because somebody can stroke your cheek and it can feel really creepy. Or they can give you a hug and it can feel just like the right thing. So what you want to communicate to a child is, tell me if somebody touches you in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable. And I agree with Rabbi Drash. We don't want to ban touch. We don't want people to never, give a hug or a pat or whatever kind of warm thing. But people should be aware of some kind of public domain.
I would also add that in terms of setting up, and this is one of the issues in terms of practical suggestions for synagogues and for schools, et cetera, is that rabbis and teachers should never be alone with a child, never be in the building alone with a child. When I think about this, I'm the rabbi, you know, people's schedules are busy and things like that, and somebody wants to come 9 o'clock at night to meet the rabbi to talk about an issue, and there's nobody else in the building. Well, they shouldn't meet. They should go for, I don't know, go to Second Cup, go to Starbucks, go someplace else, but go where there's somebody else around. You have a youth leader, and it's after a program, and some people are dropping people off. I don't know if we want to have as a policy that we allow an adult to be alone in a car with a child whom he's not related. Now, it may make things complicated and difficult, but you will solve your problems by being proactive and saying this is not something which is acceptable, and let's figure something else out. If it means dropping off the kids at a certain place and the parents will have to come and pick them up, or he'll drop off the last two or three kids at somebody's house and they'll work something out. But if we know as a matter of policy that they can't be alone with each other, and then if we find out that they were, then even your sociopaths are going to be kept in check. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes very, very important. You have offices and rooms with no windows, right? Should the youth leader or should the rabbi have an office in which there's no window? So he's seeing somebody, you want confidentiality, you want privacy, should be able to close the door? Or should there be a window there with a screen that somehow protects the privacy, but yet at the same time allows other people to see into the room? This is in everybody's interest, the potential victim, but the rabbi as well, who can be perhaps falsely accused of something and then have no way around. And Baruch Lanner in the office was pulling down his shades. Well, there's something very significantly wrong about that, and that should have been a red flag for the people who were around him.
Can I ask them a question? In Israel, we're working on something called a takanon, where we have all of these things in place. One of the things that we're working on is having a, I don't know how do you say that in English, a takanon. Help.
Policy.
A policy paper about what is considered proper behavior between a teacher and a student. And there's an attempt now to publicize this among all institutions, even to get the Ministry of Education to officially have it as part of their rules. Late night discussion. I mean, all those things that you're talking about. There are ways to prevent the kinds of things that are happening. It's never foolproof, but it certainly would go a long way.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask one more question, and then we're going to throw it open to the floor. I really, from the point of view of the victim, I'm interested in two things. Number one. When you talked about forgiveness, in terms of, you were thinking more of expiation for the perpetrator. There is a line of thought out there that it's a method of release for the victim to do the forgiving. In other words, so that should they be encouraged to do so from that point of view? And I guess on another level, psychologically, should victims of abuse be encouraged to testify or confront their former abusers, or is it counterproductive? Will it re-traumatize them, et cetera? So,
I'll respond to that. I think that really kind of falls in the same general category as the trauma survivors in general. I think the option should be made available, but then people need to choose individually what's best for them. Because for some people, getting involved, for Mrs. Klitzner, being involved in this in a public way and traveling and speaking is a ongoing work. In terms of metabolizing an experience of long ago. For some people, they do not want to come forth, and I'm not talking about because of all the shame, stigma, but they need to stay quieter about it. And I think that there, one size doesn't fit all. You know, we saw this a lot after 9/11, where there was an enormous effort to get all these policemen and firemen and workers, you know, to sort of abreact and to talk it out and whatever. And some people are not disposed in that direction. But we need to make it available for people to have this opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. My concern is that a person shouldn't feel obligated and forced to forgive if they're not able to do that. And that's something that needs to be worked through, both with the therapist and with the rabbi in consultation with regard to that. And the second question I forgot. And I
wanted to come was really whether they should be encouraged to testify.
Oh, regarding the testimony, that becomes very important. We have set, one of my involvements with through the Rabbinical Council of America was as chair of the setting up protocols for accusations against rabbinic improprieties. So what do we do with somebody comes with a complaint against a rabbi? And we have a whole wonderful protocol. I think that the organization has stepped up to the plate responsibly to deal with it. Interesting problem. Woman calls, Rabbi so-and-so did so. This is the situation. We take the reports. We speak it. We begin to investigate. Now the organization has to make a decision. But the rabbi has a right to defend himself. And we have a right to try to investigate. How do you do that if the individual can't confront his accuser? I'll tell you, but I don't want to speak in front of the rabbi.
Yeah.
How responsible is that? So we want to stop, if it's true, we want to stop this rabbi. But how do we do it in a way that's fair and that's just and follows all the protocols that any system of justice and fairness and equity would expect? So that becomes a problem then. This is the problem we had in the Colco case and other cases. If a victim can't come forward, look, this Colco who I spoke about for 40 years allegedly, right, was involved with all of these kids. Eventually he was arrested because there were two criminal complaints against him. I take credit for convincing the parents of this 9-year-old to make the phone call to the district attorney's office. And he was arrested. Eventually it was a plea bargain to 2 counts of child endangerment. He's not even a registered sex offender. 2 counts of child endangerment. The claim of the DA's office was the parents didn't want their children to testify in court. The parents deny that. Be that as it may, let's assume for sake of argument it was correct. So we can't get to the next step unless, in any system of justice, unless victims will come forward and testify. So it's very, very, you can't force them. We don't want to re-traumatize them at the same time. We can't protect the larger community without that happening. And that's an interesting problem that we face.
I want to say something about what's going on in Israel now, something actually very exciting. There's a committee, a large committee that's made up of educators, rabbis, psychologists, social workers, heads of midrashot, and they are starting to hear complaints from people who have these complaints. And one of the things that they're doing is they don't necessarily have to have a confrontation between the accuser and the accused. They listen to the. It's usually a woman. They listen to the woman. She goes through a long series of interviews with these different professionals. They then meet separately with the person who's accused and ask probing questions based on what they've heard from her. And they've done, from what I've been hearing, I spoke to somebody who's working on this, and she said they're doing amazing work. There are now dozens of women that have come forward, and there have been conclusions that have been reached. You don't have the problem of the legal system requiring this basic confrontation between the two of them. They can actually reach a conclusion and make a decision about the future of this rabbi without any kind of confrontation.
I love this.
Yeah.
Are there questions from the floor? Do people have questions or no? No? Okay.
Well, while we're waiting, just add one thing, because we've been focusing on teachers, rabbis, and strangers being involved with children. Somebody who heads a social service agency in Muncie, dealing with the mostly right-wing Orthodox community there, said that the bigger numbers that they're seeing in terms of victims of child abuse, of pedophilia, of sexual abuse, is through incest. And we haven't even touched that. I don't even know. How to begin to even have that conversation. But it's important to put that on the table, and just as it's important for responsible rabbis and teachers to keep their eyes open and to look for the red flags and to listen to what kids are saying or not saying or how they're acting or not acting and to respond to it in a positive and an aggressive way and a proactive way, it's important for parents and families to keep their eyes open as well and to look for those red flags in terms of interaction within the family.
Mrs. Klitzner, Dr. Friedman, Rabbi Drach, thank you very, very much.